This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Hello and welcome to The Latest in LGBTIQ plus health and policy, the podcast that brings you conversations with leading voices in LGBTIQ plus health and well-being. I'm your host, Triana Butler. Thanks so much for joining me today. In this episode, we have Greer McGeary in the studio. She's a long-standing community member and advocate and a life member of Seahorse Victoria, the longest continuously operating trans social support group in Victoria, now in its 50th year. She first attended Seahorse more than 20 years ago. She served as president in 2005 and 2006, then came back on from 2009 until just recently. Her career has spanned public service with the Department of Civil Aviation, along with small business ownership and decades of community involvement through service clubs, Toastmasters, and peer-led spaces. Here is my conversation with Greer McGeary. Greer McGeary, thank you so much for joining us today on The Latest.
Thank you for having me.
So good to have you here. And also, a lot of the time people do these interviews and they do it online and we're kind of very distant. So it's nice to have you like here in physical space. It's a rarity. I appreciate it.
Well, one of the things I've learned is it's much better doing it in person.
That's what I've heard, yes. Now, Greer, you've said that learning to be true to who you are has been central to your life. What did that kind of learning look like for you over time?
Well, like a lot of trans people or even anyone, have known about something different in their life, all their life. My earliest memory is as a toddler, but I was a fairly tall kid. So in my teenage years, I loved my athletics, running, track and field, cross country, but I was at my full adult height at 16, so I was a big kid, but I've always had this thing that, and I'm in the middle of five brothers, so mum at 5'3" is the only woman in the house, and but I've always sort of thought, oh, I'd like to wear that, you know, I'd buy these, as we called them then, stick books, and not so much looking at the stick as the clothes and thinking, oh, gee, I'd like to wear that. And but knowing that back in the 60s and going into the early 70s, you just knew that the society sort of looked down on difference. And but I came to work in Melbourne in 1970 and met a lovely woman and we got married, but it was something it's gnawed at me all my life, and it's something that I just had to grin and bear it for a long time. It did cause some issues in the relationship. And, you know, from that, you know, like I know I'd sort of, like a lot of people in the past, you'd sort of collect clothes and you'd hide them away and then you'd purge them and grit your teeth and sort of, no, I won't do this, because I didn't know any other trans person and I had no language for it, really. You know, the only visible thing were drag queens.
That's such a common theme, is not having the language and, you know, because people don't talk about it, not being able to see yourself in that and go, oh, yeah, that's my experience. And then you meet other people who do know that. And, yeah, they've all had very similar experiences, hey?
Yeah, that's right. And, yeah, like I had quite a successful career with my original career in Department of Civil Aviation. And then when I got a package in 92, we bought into a shoe shop franchise. And but in all those times, we had four kids. We had involvement in kids' sporting clubs on committees and service clubs such as Apex and Rotary and things. So I sort of had a fairly standard sort of life, but this was always there. And I think I learned really that when you bottle up sort of things and you're not willing to go and seek help or seek some sort of resolution to why you feel this way, it does cause tensions within relationships.
Now, I know that you began your gender affirmation journey a little later in life. What did that kind of self-acceptance open up for you that hadn't felt possible up to that point?
That's always a $64 question, I think, is the answer. But I might just do a little bit of lead into that because, you know, we had our business. I'd been chair of our franchisee committee. I was used to putting my hand up and being on things. And I was having my turn as president of Rotary Club and in the middle of 1998. And on the night that I was inducted as the president, I'm standing there in the dinner suit. My wife is all nicely frocked up, 100 people in the audience. And just before I sort of gave my speech, I just had this overwhelming sense that only if they could see me. And it wasn't me looking as you're seeing me now, but it was a sense of standing behind a mask. I use the term facsimile to a number of people over the years, and they've gone, "What's a facsimile?" that was really the catalyst that I'm going to have to deal with this, and because of issues with the business and the big shopping centre redevelopment over the next 6 to 9 months, we end up lost all our money in a business, and you know, with big massive shopping centre redevelopment, and but our kids by that stage, the two oldest ones were well and truly adult, and the two younger ones were sort of at year 12 and just left school, so it wasn't a big thing that we were just by ourselves, and a long story to go with it, but in the end that was the catalyst that sort of made me go and finally deal with it, and we were living in Tasmania when that happened.
Which was a very different thing. I mean, I think, when did they legalize? It's a separate thing, but it's, you know, adjacent. When did they legalize homosexuality or decriminalize homosexuality? It was...
Oh, it's only in the last 10 to 15 years.
Yes, but it's a very, very different environment to be out in Tasmania.
Well, it wasn't so much being out, but I went and saw I tried to look around for it, and I found a... at that time, we were in Hobart Council for Sexual Health, and saw a counsellor there, and he did introduce me to a trans person who was very open about themselves, and you know, sort of that really sort of said, well, we've got somewhere to go eventually, and so that started me on the journey, sort of. In a way, I'm a sort of a pragmatic sort of person, so I sort of didn't, you know, I was understood that you just don't go and jump out from behind a tree and go ta-da. but I did know about Seahorse through having seen something in magazines over the years, but I managed to get a transfer back to Melbourne in... 2001, and I made contact with Seahorse later that year, but I'd been working for Qantas in their call centre with the collapse of Ansett and then the 9/11, and my now late brother rang up wanting to know if my son wanted some work, and I said, I'm happy to take it because I was sick of working in a call centre.
Well, you mentioned Seahorse now in their 50th year, the yes. longest continuously operating trans social support group in the state. You are a life member of Seahorse Victoria, so I know it means a lot to you. What makes spaces like Seahorse so important, especially for people who, you know, are so isolated and at the time when there's no social media to connect with people through?
One of the things I think about Seahorse, and I must recount when I first finally went on, I finally worked up in Rainbow of all places with my brother for a while, and in a gypsum pit of all things, driving a front end loader and a bulldozer. So the first meeting I went to Seahorse was in May of 2002, after 4.5 hour drive to Melbourne, and then finding a motel in St Kilda, and I got out to the venue, and as I walked around, it's got a glass panel door, and I thought, gee, there's people in there as badly dressed as I am. And that was in many ways quite comforting, because it sort of started to bring a bit of reality to thinking about where I was at. Because when you're isolated and in your own bedroom or flat by yourself, a certain amount of fantasy element can creep into the way how you're thinking about things. And I think a little bit of reality sort of brings it back to that. But with the space of Seahorse, because the venue has never been advertised, it gives a sense of security and privacy for those who do turn up. So back in those days, you normally went and personally met with the secretary or another club member. These days, we just a telephone call is all we really talk about, more or less, to sort of say, is it suitable for what your needs, or is it you need that confidentiality and privacy, and that allows people to make a valid judgment. But it also gives us a sense that somebody is really genuine in the way they did, because around the time that I joined and earlier, the internet wasn't really active, and so predator types were around. And it was a way of just ensuring that those who came along were genuine about their own circumstances or genuine allies.
Yeah. Now, for those who haven't heard of Seahorse, maybe they're not familiar with it, could you talk me through a little bit about the organisation, what you all do, and maybe what like a typical Seahorse Victoria meetup might look like?
Well, it's basically just a room. We provide a supper. It's very slow over the years. But this particular main meeting is to provide that privacy and confidentiality. So sit around, talk. It's about meeting others, just so that you start to feel comfortable with yourself and learn how to give what sort of perspective it needs in your life, because ultimately this is about the rest of your life. So you've got to work out where you're at the moment, your relationships and all those sorts of things. And not everyone will go on and fully transition. And so it's that sort of just a space where people can sit down, talk, drink, have a supper. And every so often we'll have a guest speaker of some sort from the likes of, say, Fintan Hart, for instance, and creative wigs for things about wigs or makeup. But the real value is just sitting down talking to people.
What does that community feel like in that space?
It feels very supportive. We've been probably a bit unlike Seahorse in New South Wales, where while they were all started up as cross-dresser clubs, because sexuality within the trans community probably mirrors a broad population anyway. So, but when people are, such as myself, are dealing with it later in life, where you worked out to 60-40, 70-30, 80-20 sort of circumstance, you've already developed a life, had a life, probably relationships, or in my case, children. And so you need to be able to make some balance in your life as to, do you throw that all away, or do you do compromise to make your life work for you?
I know you've said in the past what separates us as people is behaviour rather than who we actually are. Tell me about what that means for you in everyday life.
Yes, it's sort of really based on, and we might come to that also a little bit more detail later, but when I was in, well, it's more to do with to do unto others. So in other words, if you're walking down the street as yourself, even as your previous self, are you going to sort of come across somebody who looks different, dresses differently, and then stand there and abuse them or separate them. So it's that sort of behaviour, you know, that or you just say, oh, yeah, righto, it's... I wouldn't dress like that, but that's beside the point. That person is free to be able to do so. And it's respecting that sense of I'm an individual. These are the things that I do. But when I'm out in public, I'm going to a shop to maybe buy clothes or supermarket to buy food or the cinema or doesn't matter where. You know, I'm there for the same reason as everyone else.
Well, it's bodily autonomy, right? Like, it's having the ability to choose what you do with your body.
That's true. So it goes back to, or the way I thought about it over the years goes back to when I was in Form 4 or Year 10 for younger people.
Thank you for the translation. I appreciate that, Greer.
Our class was going to, it was a beautiful day, just a bit like we're in the studio at the moment, looking out the nice sky blue. And the elderly teacher that was supposed to come in after morning recess, we'd pulled all the blinds down, turned the lights out, and we're going to have a muck up, you know, a bit of a muck up for him. And in walked a relief teacher. But it was in that class, I can remember him looking around, and that he used, and I can't remember the total context in which it came up, but he used the adage of, to be truly free, one must let others be free. And at a 21-year school reunion, so that's after matriculation, I said to him at this particular function that it was probably the single most important thing I learnt at school, because ultimately it's a variation on to do unto others. And and even though not all of us are capable of acting that way all the time, it provides that little bit of a check where you go, oh, maybe I said something inappropriate, go and apologise, or I start to do something that might be inappropriate, just check myself and realise that, you know, unless a person is abusive, just learn to accept them as they are.
There is an expression going around the internet at the moment, which is, if you want to be a villager, you have to live in the village.
Yes.
And it feels like that a little bit. Yeah. One thing that I think a lot of trans people have in common who have transitioned or who have found that safety to be able to express themselves in the way they know how to is the way that it changes the way you relate to other people. You yourself are a different person, and that changes kind of everything around you. So I'd love to know, how did that change for you in terms of community, in terms of your family, your loved ones? When you were more comfortable in yourself, what then, how did that change how you interact with the world?
Yeah, so there's lots of things in that, but
sorry to drop a massive question on you.
No. It's trying to keep a coherent train of thought, I suppose. But my wife and we did formally divorce, and we still get on quite well because we're forever connected with kids and grandkids and great-grandchild. And so there were lots of teary conversations. And one of the things that it took me a long time to realise, and I think a lot of us do, is that I was trying to explain how I felt, and what in some ways happened was that I took my focus off her and the relationship. And that took a while to sort of thing. And I think once that twigged a little bit, it started to make things a bit more easy to do. I added myself to the kids. You know, they had no idea why we'd separated, and they thought, oh yeah, just mum and dad just drifted apart after so many years. And yeah, like it was a surprise, obviously. They had no inkling that this was the case. And it had mixed reaction, but I you know, like, particularly with our eldest, and we spent a lot of walks along St Kilda Beach here many years ago, sort of talking through, because he was more interested in the issues that he saw from his growing up rather than my issue of being coming out as trans. But that's largely resolved, and they don't care if I'm in what I call neutral mode, you know, just in jeans and shirt and no makeup and hair in a ponytail, which I do whenever I'm, I catch up with my ex or she's present at a function, out of respect for her. They don't care which way they see me, and get on quite well with them. And the fact that I'm very public with my community TV work as well, and also having been the president of Seahorse for many years. So that really made a big difference. And one of the things that I did when I'd been enrolled at the Monash Gender Clinic, one of the conversations with the psychologist was that, well, if you're going to eventually live full time, then maybe what you do is compartmentalize a little bit, so because you still need work, maybe you find something to do outside of that and just go along as yourself. And I ended up joining Toastmasters. I knew what it was all about because of my involvement with service clubs.
For those who don't know what Toastmasters is.
Well, Toastmasters is, well, it's 100 years old now, based out of America, and it has a program based around speaking, basically, in public, but it's structured like a meeting. So there's different roles in the meeting, from the MC, impromptu speaking thing, prepared speeches, and the main key element is the evaluation process, where so if you do a speech, somebody's allocated to provide an evaluation of the speech, not the content, but the way you go about presenting the speech. And it's a personal feedback, but the idea is to learn how to do it positively, with some suggestions for maybe next time you do a speech that you consider doing this or that. And it's a club-based system. In Melbourne, there's quite a few clubs all over Melbourne. And so that was, I went along to that, and that was 18 years ago.
And you're now a senior judge in Toastmasters?
People ask me why I didn't go into competition speaking, and I say, like, I'm a competent speaker. I'm not a competition speaker. And but I got involved in judging things I'd sort of been involved in with Apex back in my 20s and 30s, and been very well respected as a chief judge at competition and things like that over the years. And the thing that I really liked about Toastmasters is the diversity of people there. It's a relatively mainstream organisation in the sense, so Seahorse, and that has got a specific purpose. Toastmasters has got a specific purpose, but it's a mainstream thing where anyone can come along, and the diversity of people we have in the club that I'm involved in, we've got people from all over the world, and there's no need to explain yourself. And that's really the thing. I'm there for the same reason everyone else is. And in the end, you become valued for who you are and what skills that you may have.
Now, Greer, I know you mentioned just a second ago about Seahorse and you being the president of Seahorse, and you stepped back from that just recently. Does this kind of feel like a new start for you? Because I know you've been doing it for a number of years, right?
Yes.
How far back?
I did a stint as a president for 1 year in 05-06, because being in a service clubs, I was used to putting my hand up to be on the committee, and then work and things got in the road, and I resumed it back in 2009, and apart from a year and a half when somebody else did put their hand up, but I basically did most of the work anyway, but it was no one else kept on putting their hand up. And I took the view that the, like a lot of particularly social support type groups, it was there for when I needed it. So I wanted to ensure it was still there for when somebody else needed it. And but being the front person of a group like this, you get involved in all sorts of things. While I've been very public, I'm not sort of the political sort of advocate, but I've been involved in things such as the state government's Unsaid Says a Lot campaign and things like that. Until just recently, when somebody else volunteered that they would continue on the club, and it's just allowing me to not be the person responsible and stepping back. And
how do you feel about that?
I feel quite relaxed about that. It's it was never my intention to be a long-term president, because I have taken the view that it's not meant to be my club. It's meant to be there, so that's been easier than some other clubs I've been involved in the past, where the leader of the club, it's their club and their way only, and not there for the ideals that it was set up for.
So how are you feeling about, you know, what's next for you? Because now all of a sudden, I've got to imagine there's a little bit more free time on your hands. There's a little bit more, less of the brain having to take up the admin thinking, all of that kind of side of things.
Yes, there's still a little bit of things to do to finalise my sort of involvement and ensure that the person that took over from me is gets a bit of a head start, as it were, because they've only just taken over in the last couple of months. But being retired, my biggest concern, I suppose, as being an age pensioner, is that how do I survive? You know, that's things. But I'm very much aware of making sure that mental health is high on the priority, so it's sort of keeping up with family fairly regularly. You know, not that we've ever lived in each other's pockets, we're not that sort of family, but I keep up on my activity with Toastmasters for a while because I enjoy that. It's and I'll remain involved in Seahorse as well. At the moment, I'll continue with my Bent TV, community TV work, and sort of in a sense, I'll remain first point of contact for Seahorse for, you know, indefinite period.
Greer, one of the things you often speak about is freedom being something that we owe each other. What does that mean to you now to be truly free?
Yes, it sort of touches back on what I was saying a few moments ago about respecting somebody else's freedom, because if I don't respect somebody else's freedom, they're not going to respect my freedom. And, you know, we see around with the pushback against trans around, particularly from the US and the UK and certain religious authorities, that they and other public figures, that the trans person is seen as another. It gives somebody license to attack you. But if you, and that's to do unto others. So if somebody's attacking you, you might feel what you want to attack them. So the way I try to approach it is I treat everyone the same, and make that initial contact and then see what happens from there. You know, always be polite, courteous. So it's really a case of let's respect each other, and that's how I sort of continue to do it. I want to go about my business, my daily life, to make my life work for me, and I can see that you do that. Why don't we just respect that and accept it as it is?
How do you feel about the state of the world and where things are going for trans rights? Because I know that you have had a very close view of how that's been happening through your work with Seahorse, but also just in general, the world has changed even over the last 5 or 10 years, let alone the time you've been involved at Seahorse.
And it's probably one of those how many different paths you can go down to try and explain something. What I just try to, you know, on a personal level, and having been the front person for Seahorse, and is go about my daily life in a way that, in a sense, teaches by osmosis. Being in Toastmasters for 18 years, there's people in Victoria, South Australia, Tasmania who know me, who respect me. I know when I was first joined, there were various people around who might say to somebody else, "What's with that? I don't understand it." But they've never been critical of me and learned to just accept me as a friend as well as a competent person. And that means that when they're likely to see something on TV that's adverse about trans people, they say, "Well, I know somebody, and they're not like that." And the same with the TV conversations is, I don't just interview trans people, but people who have a story to tell about inclusion and just getting on and doing something in life without necessarily being a critic of somebody else's life.
Have you found that acceptance has improved over time? Does the world feel more accepting now than it did when you first came out to yourself, I guess?
Melbourne's been very accepting. When I first joined, I joined in 2002, Seahorse, and the anti-discrimination laws in Victoria only changed in 2000, and it's been obvious from that point on that the more you're out and about, the vast majority of people accept you. And one of the things that Seahorse used to do was to keep, "Oh, here are trans-friendly places to go to," but we stopped keeping those lists a long time ago because you go anywhere, and it's really only your behaviour that's going to determine how other people accept you.
Greer, if there's someone listening to this show right now and, you know, maybe they're still finding their way, maybe they're still coming out to themselves, maybe they're not coming out at all, but they're just inviting people who they're close to in to their life to let them know about that, what would you want to tell them?
For those who are just starting out, I think one of the first things you should realise that the sky's not going to fall in and the ground's not going to open up, as much as it might seem like it's going to happen.
Yeah, but it felt like that.
I know, it does feel like that when you first start to try and broach the issue with particularly loved ones. But to do it in a way that's respecting the other person too. So in other words, it's, and I mentioned earlier about jumping out from behind the tree, is in many ways that's the worst thing you can do, because the shock and awe at that moment might seem, "Oh, everyone remained quiet and seemed accepting." No, they're in shock. is to broach it cautiously. Everyone's time scale is different. It'll stretch to suit your needs. You're the only person who knows precisely about you. So when you talk to people, you need to be able to understand, have some understanding how they might react, and therefore the way you go about approaching it. You know, just take small steps. Don't necessarily put it on Facebook. Well, that's jumping out from behind the tree in a sense. You know, take it cautiously. Come to a group like Seahorse or, you know, the Transgender Victoria, or you might find a group through the internet. But just be cautious. Don't make big assumptions that because you say, "I know I'm trans, therefore everyone must call me by the right pronouns." And we're smart enough to know when people are deliberate or just accidental, and don't try not to get too wrapped up in, "Oh, they call me the wrong pronoun." Hello. Not everyone is fully aware of it, but we do know that some people deliberately do it to irritate you, and that's behaviour. And you can quite rightly call it out, but do it in a way that's not aggressive. Do it subtly.
Greer, it's been so brilliant chatting with you today. Greer McGeary, long-standing community leader, advocate, life member of Seahorse, thanks so much for joining us today on The Latest. Really means a lot to have had you here.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much to our guest, Greer McGeary, for joining us today on the show. Brilliant to have you here. If this podcast has raised any issues for you, you can reach out to QLife. They provide Australia-wide anonymous LGBTI peer support and referral for people who want to talk about a range of issues, including sexuality, including gender, bodies, feelings, or relationships. QLife services are free, and they include both telephone and web chat support delivered by trained LGBTIQ plus community members from across the country. QLife is available every day from 3 p.m. till 9 p.m. in your local time zone. For more details on that, head to qlife.org.au. If you'd like to suggest a person you want to hear being interviewed for the podcast, we have an email address that you can contact us at. It is info@lgbtiqhealth.org.au. Just please put the word podcast in the subject line so we know why you're trying to get in touch with us. I'm Triana Butler. Thank you so much for being here. I'll catch you next time.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.